The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Gary Knoll, I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today we have a lot on health and healing, what walking will do for your brain and your body. Also, we're going to look at the creepy science behind genetically engineered frankenfish. You know those new salmon coming your way? Well, they're about to enter our food supply unlabeled. So I'm going to tell you how they ended up genetically engineering these fish. My guest in the second part of our program will be Rabbi Arthur Waskow. Now, he is sometimes referred to as the Green Rabbi. He's a prolific author, a political activist, and a rabbi in the Jewish Renewal Movement. Back in the 1960s, he was leader in the anti-war, civil, and women's rights movement, which resulted in his arrest many times during protest. And we're going to talk about rising hatred within various ultra-Orthodox religious groups, and a look at the monotheistic scriptures that lend themselves to radical violent interpretations and behavior. And I'm going to be asking a very fundamental question, and I'll bet he's never had it asked before, so this will be kind of fun. I've always wanted to ask a rabbi this particular question, but I also wanted to ask a cardinal this question. And our iman, this question, I haven't had a chance. Today I will. So we have a lot to share. Well, there will not be an opportunity for calls because we have a packed show. Let's go right to it. We know that we should be walking. In fact, more Americans walk than any other exercise, about 60 million. But how you walk makes the difference. If you don't walk fast enough, at a very brisk pace, moving your arms and really getting a real heartbeat going, then it's called junk exercise. But if you do it right, then you can help keep your body and brain younger longer. That's according to a new study from the University of Illinois at Urbana campus. Quote, networks aren't as well connected to support the things we do, such as driving, but we found as a function of aerobic fitness, the network became more coherent. And what he's talking about is this: the networks in our brain, the brain circuits, which tend to diminish as we get older. Now, we're talking about over the age of 40, we get older. So, quote, individuals in the walking group, the aerobics training group, got by far the largest benefits. We measure brain function and found that using magnetic resonant imaging, or MRIs, that we tested a group of 20-year-olds. As comparison, the aerobic group also improved in memory, attention, and a variety of other cognitive processes. As the older people in the walking group became more fit, the coherence among different regions in the networks in the brain increased and became similar to those of a 20-year-old. That's good news. That shows that even an older person can de-age the brain if they power walk, and I'm suggesting 6 days a week, 1 hour. Berries are good, and a lot of you know that because you're taking a lot of berries each day, probably 30 different berries. But here's just one berry that has some new research from Washington State University. It's the strawberry. But it's not just a regular strawberry, it's an organic strawberry. Let me quote this from Knight Rider Tribune Business. Many people buy organic foods because they believe organic foods have higher nutritional values than their non-organic counterpart. Researchers at Washington State University wanted to find out if these consumer beliefs are accurate. They tested both organic and conventional strawberries grown in 13 side-by-side California fields. Here are their findings. The organic strawberries had significantly higher antioxidant activity and concentrations of ascorbic acid and phenolic compounds. The organic strawberries had a longer shelf life. The organic strawberries had more dry matter or more strawberry in the strawberry. They used anonymous testers working at times under red light so the fruit color would not bias them, and found one variety of organic strawberries was sweeter, had better flavor, and once a white light was turned on, the better appearance, the testers judged the other two varieties to be similar. So this was a very good study. So once again, organic outdid the genetically engineered one. One more reason why we should not be having genetic, but rather organic fruit. I use a lot of olives in my daily life. It's a good food, it's stable, but there's a lot of benefit from it, mainly because of its polyphenol concentration, or what are called the oleouropein nutrients. Here's the latest from Osteoporosis International. The strength of the olive extract on bones has been shown again. Osteoporosis is characterized by low bone mass, which leads to an increased risk of fractures, especially the hip, spine, and wrist. About 75 million people suffer from that throughout Europe and the U.S. and Japan. Well, women were 400% more likely to develop osteoporosis than men, and the authors of this study explained that previous research indicates that diabetes decreases bone turnover that is associated with impaired osteoblastic maturation and function, which means that if you're a diabetic, you're more likely to have osteoporosis and thinning of the bones. So what they did this study, and the factor in this was using olives and then olive extract, and they found that, quote, our data suggests that the oleuropein highly abundant in olive tree products included in the traditional Mediterranean diet can prevent age-related bone loss and osteoporosis, unquote. In just lay language, what that means is this, that when you eat olives, or any kind of olives, you're decreasing your risk of osteoporosis. This was done at the University of Cordoba in Spain and published in a peer-reviewed literature. So that's all good, just olives. More olives you eat, better it is. Vitamin A, C, E can reduce colon cancer risk in this new study, and this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Causes and Control. And here's what it says, quote, total intake of vitamin A, C, and E were associated with 30% lower risk of colon cancer. That was according to Dr. Stephanie Smith-Warner, Associate Professor of Nutritional Epidemiology at Harvard Medical School. Quote, after adjusting for other colon cancer risk factors, the inverse association for total intakes of vitamins A, C, and E were attenuated slightly but remained statistically significant. Now, what this says in lay language is this. By the way, this was a big study. This was using primary data from 13 separate studies of 650,000 participants. So they're saying that if you take your vitamin A, and you can get that from your food, vitamin C, I suggest food and supplements, vitamin E, definitely need supplements, then you can reduce by 30% your risk of colorectal cancer. Now, if you went vegan, you could reduce it almost to its non-existent, if it's a healthy vegan diet, especially with juices, because we know that a high-fat, high-meat diet increases your risk of colorectal cancer. Now, another one of those berries is popping up as just one of those wonder workers. Again, this is from the peer-reviewed journal, Journal of Nutrition, and this was done by Professor Salafiu at the Center for the Study of Botanicals and Metabolic Syndrome, Louisiana State University. Blueberries show anti-diabetic potential. So if you have your smoothie, or if you have your blueberry concentrate, or fresh blueberries, you become increased in sensitivity to insulin, and that reduces your risk of developing diabetes, especially those who are at risk, overweight people. And they compare this to a placebo group. So you have a 22% difference in insulin sensitivity. That's tremendous. Quote from the study, to our knowledge, this is the first reported human study that evaluated the effects of daily dietary supplementation with bioactives in blueberries on whole body insulin sensitivity in obese, non-diabetic, and insulin-resistant men and women. The uniqueness of this study relates to the design, which was randomized, double-blinded, and placebo-controlled. By design, the blueberry and placebo smoothies were identical in physical appearance and macronutrient content, with the exception of adding the blueberry bioactives, that means a powder, to the blueberry smoothie. So these findings show that if you took blueberries or blueberry powder for 6 weeks, you could improve insulin sensitivity, especially if you were at high risk, which probably a third of all Americans are, of type 2 diabetes. So it's just good news. So for those of you who are taking your berries, good for you. Those of you who are taking your berry concentrates, good. Those of you who are taking your powders that have the blueberry in it, terrific. All good, and the science is there to support it. And finally, a couple weeks ago I mentioned that they found that black rice rivals blueberries as a source of healthy antioxidants. This just adds to that. This is from the Department of Food Science at Louisiana University Agricultural Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And it's from a Dr. Zhu, a professor in the Department of Food Sciences. And they found that, yes, indeed, it is true that black rice, and you can find it in any health food store, is a nutritional powerhouse, and it's very good for you. And it actually has more anthocyanin antioxidants than are found in a spoonful of blueberries. So that's good. And it's low carb. So diabetics, it's terrific. So what I do frequently is I'll combine three or four different types of rice. I'll use a red rice, a basmati rice, and maybe a short grain brown rice, and then a black rice. And you cook them all together. And how I do it is I use 2.5 parts water to 1 part rice, bring my water to a boil, add in coconut, about a tablespoon of coconut, organic coconut oil. Then I pour in the rice, always rinse the rice and grains, always rinse everything you're going to cook. And then you stir it, and the oil coats it, protects it, but also keeps it from adhering. So each of the grains of rice cooks more fully. And then after a few minutes of cooking, I turn off the water, the heat. I put a glass top on and let it steep out. And then in about a half hour, I go back, and there's this wonderful, fluffy rice full of nutrition, loaded with the essential nutrients ready to eat, and then you can add your seasonings. Now, if you want to throw in some broccoli, asparagus, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, at the end, once you've got the heat off and it's steeping, then that will give a nice breakdown of the lignocellulose that otherwise is non-digestible. And so that all the healing nutrients in the vegetables are more bioavailable to you. So then you get your veggies, your cruciferous vegetables, at least one serving, and then a good quality whole grain that is rich in its antioxidants, and it's, you can do them both together. It's very easy. And then you throw in some curcumin and curry and cayenne and garlic, then you have like 10 different power foods all in one meal. And here's the difference. Mainstream rarely talks about healing foods. I go to the original scientific literature, citing the journal, the university, the article, so at least you know on this program that all the information comes from peer-review mainstream science. And even though it's not promoted by medicine, but we bypass medicine as that entity that can properly and fully translate science. So we go directly from science to the person. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment with some commentaries on that creepy science behind that new genetically engineered salmon you're about to get. And then in about 15 minutes, we're going to be talking with Rabbi Waskow on hatred by extremists in all religions. Please stay with us. Afternoon at 3 o'clock, I'll be doing an in-depth analysis of where we stand in our health, our environment, and many other issues. You won't want to miss that. I have a very good guest at that time as well. Also, I'm going to be doing on the 25th of this month a 2 to 3 hour special on vaccines. At that time, I will also have completed, along with Richard Gell, one of our scholars in residence, the most comprehensive, scientific, completely referenced and cited article ever published on why the flu vaccine, which will now include the H1N1, they're not doing it as two separate, it's all in one. In fact, there's three in one. And once again, across America as well as New York State, they're trying to make it mandatory. So we will have at that time the article that will dispute and challenge them to show how many people are actually injured and killed, how many individuals are not helped, and the fact that they're asking people who are senior citizens to take a vaccine, that there's zero, I mean zero, quality studies showing that it will help them. In fact, their own studies show that it won't help them, and yet they're mandating it. So we will have the most comprehensive program ever done on radio in just 2 weeks, less just at the beginning of the flu season, because they're starting their whole propaganda campaign, and they'll have all these talking head doctors, and they'll have heads of the CDC and the FDA and their special advisory panels, all of whom are connected to pharmaceutical companies, promoting why you should get your vaccine. Your child should get a vaccine. Your baby should get a vaccine. And I'm going to say, whether you get a vaccine or not, that's your freedom of choice. I never tell people to or not to vaccinate. I have no right to do that. What I will say is you do have a right to understand, is there science supporting its safety and efficacy? And if not, why not? Then what is it that you're taking it for? What belief do you have? And that's what we will be focusing on. We'll have at least 8 of the best people I can find who will be engaged in that 3-hour discussion. So, and these are all qualified people. So we will be networking around the world at that time. So all the vaccine information groups, all the autism information groups should pay attention, because I'm going to be dealing with new information proving that, yes, vaccines are a contributing factor to autism, even though they've done everything possible to try to deny this. But they are wrong, and we have the science on our side. So all this we'll be going into. So I just want to give you all a heads up on that. I'm doing 3 major in-depth original investigative reports as we speak. We don't, as many of you know, this is the only major radio program in the world that originates studies, originates investigations, not just reporting on them. And so this is another one of those we'll be originating. So this will be something you can cite, you can use in lawsuits. And we will have dozens, if not hundreds, of lawyers reviewing, as we do with all these major investigative reports, our science, and we have to have it methodically done where people will review all of our work before we go on air with it, before it's published, so that it will stand courts, it will stand testimony. And if you want to watch the quality of that material, watch me go up against the top doctors in the state and the top legislators in the state wanting to mandate vaccines. I was first one that day at 8 a.m. I should have been the first one to testify at the this past year and at the state under oath on vaccines, mandatory vaccines. Instead, they put me on dead last. And why? Well, they wouldn't answer that. I kept asking, you know, and so you wait there, you know, 12, 14 hours, and they figured there won't be any news media there, and there weren't. And only one person, a Dr. Michael Schachter, stayed to hear what I had to say, and he filmed it. Had he not filmed it, no one would have known what happened, but because he did and it went viral, then millions of people saw this and saw that I'm not one of those people that bears fools well, and I excoriated the people on that panel for their lack of knowledge, their lack of real science, and their lack of care on public issues. Watch that. It's still up on the website. Anyhow, that's coming at you. The most comprehensive, in-depth, and original investigative report, fully referenced, fully documented, on the 25th of this month. It's a Friday. We'll do a three-hour special. You won't want to miss it. Now let's go into our studio in New York City. I'm out filming, and just want to let you know that we have now completed all filming in India, off to another country, and we have phenomenal footage. Kara Lee's in our studio in New York City. Hi, Kara Lee.
Good afternoon, Gary. Well, first of all, I just wanted to start off and make a quick announcement that we're still looking for some volunteers with vans who might be able to help us transport some things around. To give Jessica a call, it's 646-926-5432. Again, that number is 646-926-5432. And then I was going to move on to some emails. This first one, Gary, I thought was pretty interesting. It's from a woman named Suzette, and she lives in Lyon, France, and she says she listens to the show all the time with her friends. She's 27 years old, and she's a painter. She graduated from Sorbonne. I hope I am saying that correctly.
Sorbonne,
okay. She said she heard you talking about the Impressionist paintings. It was a while ago. It was a few months ago, I believe, you brought that up. And you mentioned Picasso, but you didn't go in-depth on him. She says that Picasso is her favorite painting. And since you don't speak too much on art, she was hoping that you could answer her question about your feelings on the Impressionists, especially Picasso.
Okay. Well, the Impressionists were a unique group of individuals, principally from France. And they would go, let's say, from the mid-1800s, when it really started to take hold, until right through the the early 1920s. And you had the American-born, though she lived in Paris, and she had many exhibitions in the late 1800s, I should say, Mary Cassatt. And then you had Paul Chasson. He was an Impressionist, but then he broke from that. And you had Edgar Degas. He was a realist who didn't like to be called an Impressionist. And I appreciated his work. You had Edouard Manet, and he also didn't consider himself to be an Impressionist, but he really was one, Claude Manet. And Camille Pissarro, you had Renoir. So those are just some. You had a lot of others. But Picasso, I don't talk about Picasso not because I don't know anything about him. It's because I don't appreciate him. Now, art is subjective. And one of my friends loved Picasso, had five original Picassos, including one of his most famous. In fact, I remember going over to his house one night to talk with him, and as I went to sit on the couch and it was dark in the room, he said, "Don't sit there." And I said, "Why?" He said, "You're about to sit on a Picasso." And I turned around, sure enough, there was a Picasso on the couch. He had so many paintings. He had 186 master paintings, and there was no more room, so he just had them sitting around. And I said to him, why do you like this Picasso? And he said, well, because it was in his, you know, his rose period. That would have been from 1905 to 1908. And then he was in a blue period, 1901 to about 1904. I didn't like it. I just didn't like it. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't respect his creativity. He lived a long life. He was extraordinarily creative. He was born in 1881. I believe he died in 1973. That would have made him, 92 years of age. He was one of the most prolific ones, and he went through many different genres. For example, Cubism in about 1907. And he had darker works in the 1940s to the 1960s. His work was dark. Yet he was considered a master at the age of 13, especially when it came to drawing the human body. He went to the Barcelona Art School, and I think he did his first major work at around 1900. He was then painting in Paris, and he loved Italy. He did The Old Guitarist, he did The Actor, he did the famous one, 1903, The Life. He did the portrait of Gertrude Stein, which got him very much into that whole scene. And then he became like the go-to person. Because he was also an intellect, he was very brilliant, he had great insight. The woman ironing, the lady in the fan, the boy leading a horse, two nudes, what was it? Let's see, in his later work he did the Minotaur, the mythical half-human, half-bull, and... he had a lot of interesting relationships. He was one of the first in analytical cubism. But what I didn't like was that through all these different abstract and Rococo styles that he engaged in, you would have to interpret it. For example, the man with the mustache, which was Rococo, it was a symbolic cubism. Well, you had to guess what it was. If you looked at one of his paintings, you would never know what it was. You wouldn't know what you were looking at. The colors, the schemes, putting stuff together. Yes, it was original. Yes, it was creative. But in me, was it enjoyable? No, so that's why I don't talk about him. So there's a difference not knowing someone. Yes, I know him and his work. But I don't talk about it because I don't appreciate it. That doesn't mean I don't respect what he did. It's just I don't appreciate it. I love classical art. So if you want to talk about Bernardo Strozzi, yes. Michelangelo, yes. Van Dyck and the Italian masters. Well, Van Dyck, of course, was a Flemish master, and along with one of the greatest artists of all time, and Rubens. But these were the Renaissance. These were the great, great artists. Many were also architects. They would design cathedrals. They would design beautiful homes. And there was, in my opinion, I've never seen any artist who could paint a child that was so beautiful and brought out the angelic and the pristine and the pure in a child as did Van Dyck. Now, Van Dyck was a Flemish painter, and he was also influenced by another Flemish painter, Rubens. And Peter Paul Rubens, who was the most celebrated artist in Europe at that time. Now, we're talking about in the 16th century, the beginning of the 16th century in Antwerp. And none of these people, well, not none of them, but a lot of them didn't live very long lives. For example, one of the greatest, Raphael, he lived a relatively short life, and he is actually buried in the Pantheon, which is one of the most singularly magnificent, architecturally unique structures in the history of architecture. He painted these serene and elegant, proportioned paintings. He was born earlier. He was born, when was he born? Raphael, 1483, I believe. And his father was an artist, and so he had a chance to learn at the court where his father was a master artist. his father died early, and then he was taken on by Pietro Perugino, who himself was a master. And by 16, he was now considered a master because he was one of those prodigies. And he could just, he could do things. If you look at his Chronicle of the Trinity, these are unique things. And he's already painting the apostles and the crowning of the Virgin Mary. And a lot of the work of the great Renaissance painters were done on commissions from the churches, and mainly the Catholic Church, or the great Medici, great families of that, of wherever they were. For example, one of the most famous cities for being a patron of the arts, and one of the richest cities, was Genoa, which at that time was considered its own unique state before it was absorbed into the larger Italian country later on. And there's where a lot of the merchants, people who owned ships, people who had unique trading routes. So if you wanted to get your product to go from point A to point B, you would have to go through their shipping. And these gigantic shipping families were then great patrons of the art, because this was the humanist period, too. And humanistic values meant that you supported the arts. So every one of the families would then have a whole series of artists commissioned to work in within the family. And needless to say, then, that's where you see all of these early frescoes in the churches, the return of Ovid in 1500, St. Augustino, and the church where you had these great frescoes. And then you had one of the greatest patrons of the art, Pope Leo X, and he was considered the peaceful pope, unlike the pope that preceded him, who was the warrior pope. But could you imagine at one time in Rome you had Michelangelo at 30 and you had Leonardo da Vinci at 50 at the same time painting? And then these other great painters would come and learn, and everybody was seeing, oh, what is the latest work of this master, like Raphael? And so the Pope would commission his apartments to be painted, and suddenly a whole school of artists, maybe 50 artists under the master, would labor all day painting. And then all the other artists would come and see, what did this artist do? What did Raphael do? What did Michelangelo do? And that became the classes. You learned your class. Not only were you required to master in a school, but the schools had a way of teaching, but then you had to also you had to get commissions. Someone had to hire you, or you could never go up that ladder. So you then studied, and you studied who was doing the most innovative and most unique work. And the man who built the most beautiful home that I consider any artist has ever built in world history was Peter Paul Rubens. It is just the most sensual, beautiful, majestic structure. And that was his home. And in his home, he had a whole school. And Van Dyck worked in that school. Most people don't realize Van Dyck was a pupil of Peter Paul Rubens. And one of the reasons he finally left the city and went to Genoa was because he wanted to get out from underneath the influence of this man. And you'll see it you'll see an awful lot of the style of Peter Paul Rubens. He did these gigantic, beautiful historical scenes, allegorical scenes. But when you looked at them, I could sit for hours in front of these great masterpieces. I can't sit 3 seconds in front of many of the Impressionist paintings. That doesn't mean I don't appreciate them. It's just I don't respect their talent. But they're not anywhere near the scale of Peter Paul Rubens. You can't find an artist that's lived in the last 300 years that could touch Peter Paul Rubens, with maybe the exception of Thomas Cole. Maybe the exception of Frederick Lewis Church. Look at Christ and the coin, and so as the merchants built whole streets, and as the artists did their portraits, family portraits, and then did their interior design, and then did their ceilings and the murals, they developed their reputation, and everybody who had money wanted their homes done, and everybody had to have one of these famous artists do a signature piece. And that's how it all went. And that was the Renaissance. It was a time of humanistic values. The greatest artists, in my opinion, in history, And if you want to see something, look at any of, well, look at the great work of Francisca, and very devotional work. And then compare that with your Impressionists. And then you'll see what I'm talking about. Okay?
Thanks, Gary.
Next issue before we go to our guest.
Sure thing. One more. This is from Jason in Tennessee. He just says that he's been listening to the show for a while now and keeping note of some of the predictions you've been making, and been very surprised that, you know, a lot of the things that you're saying are coming true, and he sees that happening now, and he wants to know what your prediction is going to be for the next 2 years.
My prediction in what area?
I think just general overall society and where we're headed.
Okay, I can do this quickly, and I'll then do one more. Here's what I would suggest. I see that we're not going to have one single thing happen that will impact everyone. I believe that the wealthy, the super wealthy, the upper wealthy, meaning the very wealthy ruling class, nothing changes. It just gets better. The people who are supportive of them, meaning you don't become a very wealthy person unless you have a support system around you, those individuals will do very well because they're like a parasite on a shark. Wherever the shark goes, they go. And like a great white shark, the pilot fish that flies behind, floats right behind the shark, eats what the shark couldn't finish. And it's much like watching a crocodile laying on a bank and you see birds walking around inside the mouth pecking in between the teeth. The crocodile has a symbiotic relationship with the bird. One snap of the jaws and the bird is the next meal. Not to suggest that crocodiles don't eat birds. They do, but these little ones, they don't, because they eat the parasites. How is it they know that? How is it that there is a parasitic relationship? So when you have super powerful people like Bill Gates and Bill Clinton, you don't ever see them alone. You don't ever see them as just a human being. You always see the most wealthy or powerful people in much like a huddle of a football team where they're the quarterback, but around them are all the other players. You generally don't hear much from the players, but we should. Those are the people who control our destiny. And so if you want to know where we're going as a society, where our institutions are going, you have to look at the policies, the philosophies, the psyche, the body politics, the human or spiritual values of the most dominant individuals in any belief system. And yet rarely do you ever see them in a reflective or relaxed moment. When you do see them, it's generally because they're at an award ceremony or they're being interviewed and well rehearsed on what the questions will be. So we don't know who they are. It's what they do that we should look at. So I want to look at what Bill Gates does with his foundation. Is he, for example, building water wells in all the different villages, about 7,000 villages and small communities in Africa? Is he putting in small health clinics that would dispense medications for malaria and tuberculosis and schistosomiasis and malnutrition? Is he offering up greenhouses? Is he reforesting areas that otherwise are becoming desert? Is he giving them heirloom seeds? And is he seeing that they are getting the type of nutrition and health care and even structure that would help them live a normal life? And the answer is no. He is, however, giving them lots of drugs, medications, that I'm sure he truly believes is the best way of helping these people. Well, if you want to prevent malaria, you clean up still water, you put malaria anti-malarial nets in people's homes, and you give them medications. But what we're doing is we're seeing massive amounts of medications go in, which is making profits for the pharmaceutical company and not changing the outcome on the ground. So I look at the people, and then it gives me an idea of where we're going. On the lower end of it economically, so you have your very wealthy, those who have between a billion and up, those who are very, very wealthy, who have between 500 million and a billion, those 8 million millionaires in the United States. On top of that is 40 million upper middle class people who have at least a net worth in their assets of $1 million and generally a more conservative and live a more conservative existence. And then you have your working middle class and you have your challenge middle class. And those two together represent the largest segment of the population. You're dealing right there with approximately 60% of the population, or well over about 160 million people. Now, as of today, there is 1 in 7 Americans now officially labeled as below poverty. That's almost 50 million people. And those people historically are disempowered. You don't see them protesting. You don't see presidential candidates going out to meet with them. They rarely have anything on a positive level done for them. And they become apathetic. The people who are really the bread and butter of a society, the working middle class, are the ones who are struggling the most at this time and will continue to struggle. I'll look at and say that we will see the quality of their infrastructures decline, but not collapse. So you won't see the garbage picked up as regularly. You'll see buildings that are abandoned becoming places where dope addicts hang out. You'll see the cost of food increase, not because it has to, not because there's a lack of land or a lack of seed, but because of people on Wall Street who will speculate and make more profit on the speculation of a food because they have plenty of money. They never have to worry about their families going hungry or their communities going hungry, but they don't really attach a moral equivalency to what they do. So they're never held morally accountable, not by the people in their congregations, not by the people in their clubs or universities, not by anyone around them. That's not how institutional beliefs work. And as a result, things will get more expensive at the same that you buy. At the same time, what we own will deflate in value. I predict that we'll see between a 20 to 50% reduction in real estate values over the next 24 months. I believe that we'll have more people becoming overweight, depressed, sick. I do not see any social protest. This is not France, Ireland, Spain, or Italy. We will not see people going to the streets. We don't do that. We should. We won't. Individuals would, but they have been disempowered and disconnected from the grid. And so the media will be complicit. They will talk about Democrats and Republicans having the answers. The Democrats will say the Democrats should be in power. The Republicans say they should be in power. Neither one should be in power. Independent, progressive-minded people should be, but we're not yet organized to have that happen. So we can watch, but don't participate. When you participate, then you also at the same time acknowledge that the choices are going to be made in your name are choices you can live with. And I can't live with a bad choice. So I would rather vote for someone like Ralph Nader, who will lose, but at least establish some truth and principles and integrity so we can build from that, than to continue, as the Democrats and the liberals have, to have the wrong people, have the warmongers, have the corporatists in power. Look at Bill Clinton. How many times did Bill Clinton meet privately with the man he brought, personally brought from Goldman Sachs, head of Goldman Sachs, Robert Rubin, to be a Secretary of the Treasury? And who did Robert Rubin bring to be his chief economic hitman, the hard guy, the guy who had to go and do the dirty business, Lawrence Summers of Harvard? And who did he bring in to be the young 35-year-old on the block? The man, Timothy Geithner, who's now our Secretary of the Treasury. Those individuals work with Alan Goldsman. What did they all have in common, including Bill Clinton? They all believed that Ayn Rand, who believed in no regulation, let the market dictate everything. And they all believed that. And that's why they took away our rights. That's why they took away through the Commodity Futures Exchange Act. They didn't prosecute anyone for fraud. And they didn't stop the derivatives. At that time, it was $43 trillion. They should have. It's now $500 trillion. So do I see a good future when these people, from their own mindsets, are controlling the future? No, I do not. I see us going through a lot more tumultuous times. I see a lot more unemployment. I see good news in the financial sector, the medical sector, the insurance sector. Those will boom. The military-industrial complex will boom. But for the average individual in the average town, in the average neighborhood, in the average community, they will not. But they are not in power, and they don't realize that they have power. And so they will watch television. We will engage in bread and circuses, unfortunately, until they wake up and start to realize that they do have power. They have spiritual power, they have political power, but it cannot be within the Republican and Democratic structure. It must be outside of it. Thank you. That's all the time we have for this.
Thanks, Gary.
Now let's go over and say hello. I'm just told that my guest is standing by. And let's say hello now. Once again, I've given an extensive introduction earlier to Rabbi Arthur Waslakow, and the Green Rabbi, and author of many important books, and on topics on human rights and women's rights. And he's been around a long time, and we appreciate him being with us today. Nice to have you with us today.
Good morning, and actually afternoon by now, and shalom and salam. It's pronounced Wasco, Gary.
Wasco, okay. Now, my first couple of questions, I want to address the main issue at hand, the rise of Islamophobia in the United States. However, there was a Washington Post ABC News poll recently that shows how much Islamophobia has increased since 9/11. 49% of those surveyed held a negative view of Islam, and 37% viewed it favorably. Compare that with a 2002 poll, which found that were almost reversed. 47% of people viewed Islam favorably and 39% with disdain. So among all those who were negative towards Islam, the single major reason was that it encouraged violence. Of course, we can find elements in all of the monotheistic religions. One only needs to recall fanatic hate sermons against Jews by Father Charles Coughlin. Even Hinduism, if we take a literalist view of the Gita, that lend themselves to violent interpretations. But now that 9/11 is almost a decade behind us, what do you see as being the single major cause for why there would be almost a 10% increase in hatred towards Islam in the American population?
Before I respond to that, let me just add that even Buddhists, for example, in Japan during the 1930s and 40s, and Sri Lanka more recently, it's not just the monotheistic traditions. Even secular traditions like socialism have been warped into violence against other people, as, you know, Stalinist Russia made clear. So, but to come back to your question, I think clearly has been an increasing under the surface until about 5 months ago, increase in fear, anger, distrust, suspicion of Islam in general. And I think there are two major reasons. One is that the United States has been at war with explicitly two Muslim-majority countries, covertly semi-war in Pakistan, and threats of war against Iran, and a close alliance with the Israeli occupation of Muslim-majority Palestinian areas in Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank. And during that period, there has also been not only the 9/11 attack, but more recently there have been other attacks and atrocious incidents done by people who proclaim themselves to be Muslims. So even though the vast majority of Muslims in the world abhor such terrorist attacks and the beheadings of people like Daniel Pearl and so on, even though the vast majority of Muslims in the world abhor that, and the vast majority of their leaders have said that, Americans have absorbed both. We are at war with Islam, and some Muslims, that we're at war with some aspects of Islam, and some Muslims are at war with the United States and the West, and that results in a wave of generalized, in the atmosphere of war in general, which usually stimulates hateful emotions, and in this case as well. So that's one thing under the surface. The other thing is that we are going through the worst economic disaster in America since the 1930s. You mentioned Father Coughlin in the 1930s and Henry Ford's Dearborn Independent. Millions of Americans were buying into venomously anti-Semitic attacks. In the 1930s, for many, many, many Americans, Jews were still kind of strange. Not in New York, not in Baltimore, but in many cities, and certainly in the great Midwest and the far West, Jews were strange. Now, okay, now in America, Jews are not strange, but for many Americans, Muslims are. They don't know Muslims. They have no information whatsoever about Islam in general, about Muslim religion, and they haven't met on a daily basis Muslims, at least who they know are Muslims. So the factors of being embroiled in unwinnable wars, and specifically wars against Muslim-majority societies, and a kind of general sense of cultural unease and uncertainty and a sense that America is going in weird and not good directions, plus the economic disaster, I think has provided a kind of underground feeling of fear of the foreign. It's expressed partly by fear of Hispanic Americans, both legal and illegal immigrants to the United States, and for sure in fear and suspicion of Muslims. Okay, all that's like gasoline under the surface. And then, beginning in May, there were specific people who decided to light matches to the gasoline. It's really interesting. If you look back in December of 2009, the New York Times had a front page article about the plans for Cordoba House, and it was an article about, hey, this really interesting thing is going to happen in Manhattan. And there was no fury, and there was no fuss, Daisy Kahn, the co-founder and co-leader of the Cordoba Initiative, married to Imam Faisal Abdul Raus, appeared on Laura Ingraham's conservative show and was interviewed. And Laura Ingraham ended by saying, really interesting what you're doing. It sounds good to me. No fuss, no fury. Then in May, Pamela Geller, a kind of ultra-right-wing, utterly Islamic-phobic Islam hater, and the organs of Rupert Murdoch, a right-wing, enormously powerful publisher who owns the New York Post, in England, the News of the World, which has just been uncovered in the last couple of weeks, has been tapping the phones and the emails of many, many, many leaders of British society, including the royal family.
I'm just going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience. You can continue listening to us by going to GaryNall.com. Please continue.
Okay, sure.
And by the way, I'm going to continue our interview. The next program is allowing us to go into their show, which I appreciate, so that the important questions that you're answering and some that I should say the importance of your answer, some of these questions are enlightening us, so we're not going to be shorted of any of your insights today.
Thank you very much. And salam and shalom again to all your listeners and to you. So these right-wing publicists, for their own right-wing political reasons, touched a match to the gasoline of fear and suspicion of Islam that was already there but had not really exploded. And then politicians, again, right-wing politicians like Sarah Palin and Gingrich, realizing, wow, there's real maybe political advantage to be gained from this, they also started throwing matches in the gasoline. And it's not till May that you then get this explosive firestorm of hostility where it surfaces not only in New York City, but around the country with people opposing mosques and now beginning to, there's been at least one case of arson, a number of cases of vandalism, etc. So, and I think we may have begun to turn the corner. I think the threat to burn the Quran may actually turn out to have been a godsend. It was so outrageous and so much smelled of what the Nazis did in 1933 that I think that turned the stomach of lots of Americans who hadn't made up their minds yet. In New York, people are beginning to get a lot more information about Park 51, the plans for the Muslim-rooted but open to the world cultural center, which is not the Ground Zero Mega Mosque. It's two very long New York City blocks from the where the World Trade Centers were, and it's not a mega mosque. It's a cultural center modeled on the Jewish Community Center of 76th Street and the 92nd Street Y. That's what the people who have been planning it, that's exactly what they saw. Wow, the Jewish community could set up these centers which were open to everybody with swimming pools and music and the arts and crafts and lecture halls and all that. And they weren't closed off. They're not Jewish community centers in the sense they only do Jewish stuff. And the leaders of the Cordoba Initiative said, well, that's terrific. And there are thousands of Muslims who live and work in Lower Manhattan, and there should be a place for them, and there should be a place for everybody there to come swim, to learn cookery, to learn the arts, et cetera, et cetera. So, in fact, the first effort to locate this place it was many, many blocks even further north in Manhattan, and the real estate developer who was trying to make it work, the financing fell through, and then he found the place that he did buy on Park Place to make available to Park 51, to the cultural center. So it's this combination of the underground fear and suspicion of an Islam that most Americans don't know anything about, except that we're sort of at war, and that generalizing that to all of Islam, and then the economic disaster, and then, as I said, people deliberately lighting matches for their own political advantage.
I appreciate that in-depth answer. Thank you. Now I'm going to ask some questions that I haven't had a chance to ask before, and I hope that you give us your insights on these in a way that we can grow and expand because of them, all right?
Sure.
I have just four. And again, we have no rushing here. Our next program is going to push back their start time so that there is take all the time you need. In all the scriptures of Judaism and Christianity and Islam, there are statements that when taken literally could give support for radical and violent behavior. There are many ways of interpreting sacred texts. In fact, the great Christian scholar Origen in the second century, who learned scripture from early Jewish rabbis during his visit to the Holy Lands, described four kinds of interpretation of scripture, and the literal interpretation was considered the lowest, most banal and mundane, whereas the mystical allegorical mode was considered the highest. So my question is this. Why are not the leaders in the religions of Bnei Israel, who denounce the more violent interpretations of their scriptures, doing more to challenge and reform the way believers should understand their sacred texts and deconstruct the illusions of the radical literalists?
Well, it's a great question. And I must say that I'm not among the people who would try to purge from the Torah the disgusting parts of Torah. I recognize that they're disgusting. Yisrael, the word that in English comes out Israel, not the state, but the people, Yisrael means the God wrestlers. It came from that moment when a guy named Jacob or Yaakov, which in Hebrew means a guy who's a heel in the literal sense, he grabbed his brother's heel when they were still not quite yet born to try to get born first. And he was also a heel. He was deceitful. He was a trickster. He wrestled with his brother all his life until a night came when he wrestled with God instead. And then the next morning he was able to make peace with his brother. So, and he was renamed the God wrestler, Yisrael. So I think that we are all in a position of having to wrestle with reality, with truth, with the God who did not just you might say, make a clone of holiness, but created a world in which we struggle our way toward trying to make holiness and often in the process make ugliness and disgustingness. The way I understand all the traditions, and you're right, I mean, and it's not only the monotheist ones, it's the others as well, that we all have our roots in an effort to understand and compassionately connect with the unity of the universe. Whether we call that unity God, or we call it, as Marxists used to at least, the historical dialectic, or as liberals might, the human rights, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, that there's this deep sense that there is some unity. Now the ecologists would, and many of us would, talk about the unity of life on the planet. There's a deep desire to connect with that unity. Okay, so when you begin to do that, how do you teach it to other folks and to your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren? What you do is create rituals, prayers, metaphors, daily practices, all of them aimed at trying to make contact with the one, the unity. That's fine. And then you bump into another bunch of people who are trying also to connect with the deep unity of the universe. And what do you know? Since the deep unity of the universe is infinite, the only reflections or refractions it can have in the life of physicality and Earth and human society is multiple, is diverse. So one community, which is trying to get in touch with the one and has created its own forms, its own culture for doing that, bumps into another one. And then there are two possible responses. One is to say, wow, of course, you're trying to get in touch with the infinite, so are we. So of course we would find different ways, because the infinite can't come out uniform, but unique. That's one way. Let's learn from each other. That's one response. The other response is, oh, how dare you? There is only really one way to get in touch with the one, and we figured out that way, and you guys don't have that, and therefore you're not only mistaken, but you're obviously lying and corrupt and deceitful, and it makes sense to kill you. So all of us have that danger, that temptation, in our different traditions. And all of our traditions have a piece of it. So my answer would not be to purge our traditions of, you know, what I think of as the bloody streaks in the sacred cloth, but to say what is sacred is the conversation. They had a conversation 3,000 years ago, which included everything from nonviolent resistance to tyranny, like what the midwives did in the story of Pharaoh, when Pharaoh said, kill all the boy babies of the Israelites. The midwives, who may not have been Israelites themselves, refused. They wouldn't do it. They nonviolently resisted Pharaoh's command, all the way from that to genocide, which is in the same Torah. There's a conversation. We even have explicitly the Book of Ruth, which is about how a foreign woman from a foreign community joins in creating what ends up being the family that leads to King David, and therefore, according to both Jewish and Christian tradition, and actually Muslim tradition as well, to the Messiah. And this foreign woman, at the same time that other aspects of the Hebrew Bible were saying, you must not marry foreign women. And there are these two different, they're coming just like we would today. They are coming from different attempts to understand how to get in touch with the one. So I don't want to throw either of them out of the conversation. I want to make up my mind as to which is the voice that I want to affirm and that I want to act on. And in fact, the presence of the bloody voice reminds me of the danger that we can fall into the bloody process. And I don't know any tradition, even the ones that have tried to focus totally on compassion and peace and so on and so on, that don't, like mostly Buddhism does. But in the 1930s and 40s, there were Japanese Buddhists who said, yay, hooray for the state that was conquering China, trying to, and the rape of Nanking. And even Buddhists were saying, yay, three cheers. So,
okay, I understand.
So you get it. It's in all of us, and I think we need to wrestle with it in all of us rather than purging it.
Okay, I respect that input, and I thank you for that. I have two more important questions. Let me just respond and hear me through, if you would, please.
Sure.
I am not the nature to have a cobra and this anti-venom in the same picnic basket. I came from a background of fundamentalistic beliefs in West Virginia. You had a Pentecostal, you had people who in some of the churches would handle snakes, believing that if they were bitten and died, it was because they didn't have enough love of God. But if they didn't get bitten or didn't die, it was because God was living through them. It is not for me to tell those people not to do that. At the same time, when we see Sharia law, and we see how it deals with women. And it also, the contradiction that if God was so important in the lives of people, why didn't he make women equally important in writing all the books of the Bible, at least as a voice, instead of something to be condemned? Because I grew up in a religion, and I'm only speaking for my own now, where women were not given the same rights. And it took many people, yourself included, myself included, and hundreds of thousands of women and men working together to acknowledge that women had not been given the rights on many levels. And what was interesting, where we would fight for a woman's right to get the same pay as a man for the same hours and same work as a man, we all stopped at the level when it came to how they would be perceived or dealt with in the religion, because we felt that was their sacred belief. If they chose to be a part of that religion, they had to take what came with it. I did not subscribe to that, but I also realized I have no right to tell a person what their sexual, political, or religious orientation should be. That's for their determination. My belief would be, at this point in my life, that I would like to sit with the leading scholars and in Islam, in Christianity, in Judaism, and have them tell me, and by extension, tell those who would be interested, what in that religion could people use to interfere in the process of love and nation building and friendship, and to acknowledge that that is there, but to disavow that as a part of what is meaningful, because we all know that these religious texts were written by human beings. And no different than if someone's writing today, they could only write based upon what their own perceptions, their own realities of that time and that place, with their own experiences, their own levels of values, and some therefore are of greater compassion and others of no compassion. And I believe that we are finally at a point, far, far more than Martin Luther was in his day, where we can see the world or see the contradictions in the existing body politic, and let us not disengage ourselves that religions also are body politics. And so we can be truly spiritual. I would like to have what is most spiritual in each religion be advocated by those who are more progressive. So that when someone says we're going to behead you, or we're going to violate you, or we're going to do something because it's in our text, we can say, well, that's your text, and that's the old text, but let's look at what we could do to communicate and live together in harmony with a new focus where that is not what we're bringing to the table. Those are my thoughts.
I totally agree with you, and it is happening. I mean, as of now, about 90% of the American Jewish community is made up of people who fully accept the full equality of women and men in Jewish practice and in shaping the future of Judaism. That's been an enormous change that has taken place in just about 40 or 45 years. Even in what we call Reform Judaism, there wasn't really full equality of women 40 or 45 years ago. So there's been a great wave of change. And there is in the tradition, there are in the tradition many roots for that. So the question I think really is, can religions evolve? Can their practices evolve? There are now in Islam more and more teachers who are saying, you know, if you look back at the actual behavior of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, it turns out the way he behaved toward women was with enormous respect, enormous admiration, not with insistence on, you know, covering them so nobody could see who they were, etc. And if we look back at that actual practice, we begin to think that maybe what happened was the cultural overlays of Arabia, of various other societies, including Europe in the Middle Ages, overcame the Prophet's original intention. So if you look, I mean, let's go back to talking about Cordoba House and Park 51. If you look at Daisy Khan, the wife of the imam, and not just his wife dragging along behind him, but the co-founder, the co-organizer of Park 51, the co-developer of the idea and what to do about it, etc. She doesn't wear even a head kerchief, let alone the more elaborate coverings. She vigorously speaks in public, makes a difference, has made a difference both in public and in private to what the Cordoba Initiative is about. So the two of them represent exactly what you are asking for. In fact, that's one of the real horrors of the attack on them. It's like the way Karl Rove took a Vietnam War hero, John Kerry, and focused on exactly his strong point and turned it into a weak point with the Swift Boat attacks. So people have acted as if Imam Rauf and Daisy Khan were would-be terrorists when in fact they are exactly the people were saying, where are the Muslims who condemn terrorism? It's, well, there are hundreds and thousands and hundreds of thousands of them, millions, but among the most visible and the most audible have been Imam Rauf and Daisy Khan, and they are trying to do exactly what you're talking about. I think one of the great gifts that God has given America, and through America has given the world, is that, you know, one of God's best inventions was the First Amendment of the Constitution, saying state power cannot be used to support any of the versions of celebrating me or not celebrating me. All those versions have to make their way in the world by convincing people that they have sacredness in them. That was a great invention by God. And the result has been that we can develop the evolution of Judaism has been enormously enriched by not being either afraid of or trying to grab state power for the Jewish religious pattern. We knew it wasn't going to be. State power was not going to be Jewish here, and no state was going to smash Judaism here. And therefore, we could evolve creatively without fear. That's also been true of all the Christian denominations of Mormonism, of Buddhism, and of Islam. And that doesn't have to stay just inside America. It can, in fact, make a difference in the rest of the world, and it's beginning to.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you for sharing that. I have one last comment from which please select any part of it you would like to address, all right?
Okay, sure.
And I appreciate you staying on with us, and I appreciate the host of our program now allowing us an opportunity to continue with our wonderful guest, Rabbi Arthur Waskow, to share his insights with us. And this may be a little rambling, but I want to get all my thoughts out because I don't often have a chance to speak with a rabbi, scholar, humanist, spiritualist all in one. Those are my interpretations, not yours. So you don't have to argue with that.
That's fine.
All right. in my opinion, progressive Jews, and I'm not asking you to either challenge me or accept it, but I would consider you a progressive Jew, and Muslims, progressives, and I know many, Abraham Melick is one, have sometimes a difficulty in recognizing the kinship between Judaism and Islam, and they share the same father, and even in the book of Genesis, God makes a promise to Hagar that from Abraham's Hagar's son, Ishmael, a great nation will rise. And there are many other points of confluence and fellowship between the two. And the first supporters of Muhammad's prophetic mission were the Jewish tribes living in the Arabian Peninsula. You alluded to that. Yeah. And yet we can find the right-wing Jewish factions in political and religious and areas completely denying these connections and basically mouthing the same thoughts as the fundamentalist Christians that I grew up with. And you have mentioned that the Jewish community today, especially those who, I'm not saying they call themselves progressives, but I would call them progressives, are challenging this. And in all the scriptures, at least those that I'm familiar with, I believe that there is an inherent problem that lends itself to a worldwide view that condones radical violent acts based on literal interpretation when the scriptures of the monotheistic and, as you mentioned, non-monotheistics like Buddhism in the 1930s and 40s, though the Japanese were very clever, they were really using Shintoism as a progenitor virus in Buddhism to come up with the more violent extremes they came to. They're perceived solely as sacred books and divine revelation in the absolute sense, and such beliefs refuse to acknowledge the historical truth and hence the literary criticisms of the text that can shed light on alternative views of understanding controversial textual elements. For example, in Christianity, any New Testament scholar worth their salt today who knows fluently the ancient languages agrees that Paul was not the author of all the epistles. In fact, close to half are likely forgeries. And there are, of course, huge discrepancies in the recounting of stories in Jesus' life when we look at how the same stories are written in different Gospels. And in Judaism, we take if we take a hard literary critical look, we don't find the Torah as a completely unified text. Biblical scholars speak of the Y source and the E source in different lines of oral transmission that come together later and were compiled into what we now know, or at least as a Christian, what we know as the Torah. And then, of course, the Deuteronomic texts are a separate lineage of oral wisdom and are texts that enter. And Islam has a long tradition of denying the valid application of literary criticism to investigate the Quran on historical terms. And Muslim scholars, and I know several, who attempt to do so are often condemned or have a fatwa placed over their head. However, there are discoveries, and one important one is an ancient mosque in Yemen that has the potential to be the Nag Hammadi, like you find in Islam, of numerous scraps of paper full of lines from the Quran and the Hadith. And so far, there is evidence that differences in the Quranic surahs exist. So here again, there is evidence that even the absolute divine revelation in the Quran can be challenged on historical evidence. And not to denigrate, I don't do that, the messages of wisdom. I think we should honor the wisdom messages in all world scriptures and how they can improve the lives of believers, which is what you're talking about now. I do believe if people expand their vision of sacred texts to include the historical aspects as being books composed, compiled, and transmitted by human beings, there will be a stronger means of preventing radical, violent interpretations of these texts and then acting them out. Your final thoughts, sir?
Well, that is the way I go about my Judaism. And I'm, of course, not alone in that. And in a context that doesn't do that, and I've seen this talking with Muslim scholars and teachers, it is still possible to evolve because the texts themselves open up different possible aspects. Muhammad lived a life. He received revelation. I believe he did receive revelation from God. And through the course of his life, the revelation has different facets because he's living in different situations, life situations. And in my theology and in the theology of many Muslims, it's very likely that if you're living in a different situation from being a tiny minority in Mecca and persecuted to fleeing to Medina to coming back to Mecca when the city is ready to welcome you as indeed a great prophet, and on, that different facets of the infinite wisdom of the universe come through at different times. And in different parts of the Quran, one seems to find that. And there are what Muslims call the hadith, the stories of Muhammad's life, which they don't give the same weight as the Quran itself, which is directly the word of God, but which they do give enormous weight. So, and that certainly the hadith represent different aspects of Muhammad's life. And then there are a whole series, then there are interpretations upon interpretations of interpretations of what they mean. And when you check it out, it's clear that the interpreters don't necessarily always agree with each other. So that means that there is, in fact, evolution in the practice. And even if everybody in the room says, but of course the Quran is the absolute direct revelation through the angel Gabriel from God to Muhammad the prophet, peace be upon him. Even if they all say that, they then often disagree about exactly how you're supposed to live as a result. And that, I think, is A, built into all religious life, and B, offers the real beckoning, it's not just an opportunity, but a beckoning, a call from God to keep growing up. In Jewish life, for example, Rambam, the Maimonides, who absolutely thought the whole Torah, he didn't talk about the J and the E and the D and so on, strands of the Torah. But he said, the reason we did sacrifice of animals at the temple was to educate us out of sacrificing human beings. And you know what? He said, we now have grown up enough that we don't need the sacrifice of animals anymore. We've grown up. It was intended to educate us, and it did. And we grew up, and we're at another level. So he could say that it was the word of God, but that's not what God wants from us anymore. And in a sense, God was always hoping that we would grow out of it, even while it was necessary to educate us with it to grow out of something even worse. So, and he could do that even though he was committed to the utter divine revelation of the entire Torah. So I think, it's not just that I think, there is overwhelming evidence that Islam in these hundreds and hundreds of years has evolved the same way. And sometimes any of the religions, some of the folk in them get stuck, especially when they feel they're under threat. I mean, the hostility among many Jews to Islam now is only about 120 years old. And it mostly is about the collisions that resulted on a secular level as a result of the creation of the Zionist movement and the State of Israel and so on. Now, our tradition teaches that that's a really important unfolding of our religious beliefs and the will of God, and Islam, even though it in fact has some space, there passages of the Quran that affirm the special Jewish relationship to the land of Israel, was certainly taken aback when it began to happen. As in fact many Jews were. Both Reform and Orthodox Jews said, wait a minute, that ain't what we thought was going to be happening. But about 150 years ago, most of the Jews on the planet would have said, hey, we have much more in common with Islam, the absolute commitment to the unity of God, and although there have been problems living with Muslims, nothing like the pogroms that emerge from living with Christians. So the hostility to Islam actually has emerged historically. And the hostility from Islam to Judaism has emerged historically in the last 120, 150 years. So I think that was a missed, on both sides, that was a mistaken pathway. I understand why it happened, but I think it was a mistaken pathway. I think we're working ourselves beyond that mistaken turn in the path. And we won't just to go back. I mean, the reason that Imam Rauf and Daisy Khan chose Cordoba as the symbol vision was that Cordoba was the city where Muslims and Christians and Jews lived together. It was the most civilized city in Europe. It had thousands upon thousands of books when most of Europe had at most a couple of hundred books in any city. Cordoba was a center of intellect and commerce and excitement and progress, and that's what they were looking for. So it won't be like Cordoba, it won't be the same as Cordoba, but that vision is one Jewish scholars have called it the golden age of Judaism in Spain, in what's now called Spain, Andalusia, right. Under Muslim rulers. So I think we went into a blind direction on the path. And
well, we're out of time now, but let us hope that more tempered and more spiritual and loving minds are heard rather than the rants from Fox and the people who they have on, who many times are just hate mongers.
Amen, Sela. Oh, and let me, if I may, what I've been able to say, I mean, you've given me an incredible amount of wonderful time to say it richly, and nevertheless, our website, which is www.theshalomcenter.org, has obviously a great deal more about all the work we do, whether it's in this interfaith and peacemaking area or it's in ecological work to heal the planet. So let me encourage people to go there. And thank you enormously for indeed opening up such a wonderfully rich conversation. Thank you. And let me say shalom and salam. I know that much of the Muslim world had a wonderful Ramadan. And we have just come through Rosh Hashanah on our way to Yom Kippur into more and more fully the new year. May all of us live in the next year making more peace, more commitment, more connection with the One, however we define the One possible.
All the best to you and all your efforts. I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you very much. Be well.
Rabbi Arthur Waschkow, Waskow. OW. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all very much for listening to this extended version. I'll be back in an hour and a half for it with our next program. Have a nice day.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee. Yeah.